The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to bring Laura Lippman back to the program today. She's got a new novel out. It's called Dream Girl. She joins us on the phone. And are you in Baltimore?
I sure am.
It's so good to talk to you again. I just love this new novel. How did you get the idea for this?
The novel started out because I was simply interested in the idea of isolation and whether it was possible to use the trope of isolation in a big city setting, if we consider Baltimore a big city, and I guess it's, you know, kind of big. But just the idea of, you know, what if our isolation is more emotional than literal? What if we are surrounded by people, we live busy, active lives, and then something happens that makes us realize we're a lot lonelier than we think we are, that we're a lot more alone in the world? And I always jump ahead here and mention that these were ideas I was having in December of 2018, and I'm not a prophet. I didn't see what was coming. But, you know, it did sort of align with this. I was finishing this book during a time when a lot of people were finding themselves stuck at home unexpectedly and with a lot of time on their hands and a lot of time to sort of think about their lives and what they might do differently when their lives went back to what we consider normal.
And you've set the story in Baltimore, which is a city that you have a tremendous affection for.
Absolutely.
And your main character in this is a writer. And I know you were having fun having a main character who's a writer. This guy, he's a character.
He was fun to write. And he's not a great guy. He's certainly not a self-aware person. And he's made a lot more mistakes than he's willing to admit to himself, and he's been a bad guy more often than not. But he is also a writer, and a good writer, a successful one, and he's written at least one novel that's had very wide sales and critical acclaim. But his other novels have all been treated respectfully. He's won awards for other things he's done. And he's thrice married, thrice divorced, just out of a relationship with a difficult woman. He is alone in the world because he has no siblings that he knows of, and his mother has died from dementia, which is something that happened, was going slowly and then happened very quickly. And because he's moved back to Baltimore to be close to his mother, and because he now has had an accident that leaves him in bed for several weeks, he's stuck in Baltimore, which is a place he doesn't want to be. I have a lot of affection for Baltimore. Jerry Anderson, who grew up here and is about the same age as I am, does not.
And Jerry, who has had a successful career as a novelist, as you mentioned, had that one big book, which coincidentally is the same title as your novel, Dream Girl.
Yes, that made it very easy to remember.
Yeah, and Jerry, he is struggling. He's having trouble writing. He's kind of got writer's block, doesn't he?
Well, I don't think he would call it writer's block. I don't believe in writer's block, and I don't think Jerry actually believes in writer's block. I think he's got a lot of emotional issues that are weighing him down and keeping him from getting back to work. I think the distraction of caring for his mother has been more overwhelming than he wants to let on. And I think that now that he's immobilized, he doesn't feel the same fervent desire to write every day. Someone who's been writing every day for most of his life. And again, this is something that I think unwittingly spoke to the situation we've just all been through in the pandemic. A lot of people had very large expectations for themselves during the pandemic. A lot of people talked about, well, this will be when I finally write my novel. Because I'm stuck at home. And I found that interesting because, speaking only for myself and my own life, a wealth of time was actually not that useful.
Uh-huh.
Time is an interesting commodity, and while you yearn for it when it's scarce, when you're suddenly awash in it, when you suddenly have more hours in a day than you can fill, it becomes difficult to use time well. It's a kind of richness that it's hard for people to make the choices they need to make when they have so much of it.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's like becoming very rich very fast too. Like if you suddenly have all the money in the world, it might be a little bit overwhelming. Jared's life worked much better when he was ambulatory and when he had things to do and when he had his structure. Something I came to terms with over the past 10 years is that being a late in life mom was actually a blessing. At first, you're so focused on, oh my God, I have so much to do, and there's always something to do, and there's never not going to be something to do. But eventually, if you're someone who leads a busy life, I mean, isn't that the old cliche? If you want to get something done, give it to the busiest person. And I knew this from my life in the newsroom, that the parents I worked with were very disciplined and very well organized. I have found it easier to write, and I've been producing at a pretty good clip since I became a mom and have been forced to really use my time well. Because I don't have any time to waste anymore. And there was a period of time after I left the newspaper, before I became a parent, where I was awash in time, and I got my books done, but I know all too well that an abundance of time is not actually the only thing people need to do to do creative work. There are other things you need. Something you need are structures in place and whatever system works for you.
I follow you on Twitter, Laura, and I love it when you post photos of like the food you made your daughter or something that you did for your daughter, and you're such a devoted mom.
Oh, thanks.
My guest is Laura Lippman. We're talking about her new novel, Dream Girl. He's had this one successful novel, which really has put him in the financial situation that he's in. He's left New York. As you mentioned, his mom was ill, and he moved back to Baltimore ostensibly to take care of her, and she didn't live as long as he'd expected. But he's been opportunistic about this because he's moved into this big condo, and he's left the apartment in New York with the woman living in the apartment that he just as soon not see anymore. And
mm-hmm.
her name's, what is it, Margot?
Margot.
I
sold the apartment out from under Margot.
Yeah, yeah. He's very opportunistic about this. And she's kind of a classic, I don't know how you describe her, but I'm sure you've met women kind of like her, who's kind of like, well, how would you describe her?
Well, Margot is someone whose career is spun off of men. And I have to say that I created her. I have this grudging respect for Margot. I mean, Margot uh-huh. is someone who, she does work for the living that she gets through these men. She's clearly a very good sex partner. She's a good public companion, someone you can take to a dinner party or to an award ceremony. She's smart. She is well-read. She can carry on a conversation. She's comfortable in, you know, rarefied climes. I do feel that Margot sort of gives value for what she gets,
uh-huh.
that she's not just coasting. And I think that, you know, she's almost like a courtesan. I do have this respect for her. But Margot being Margot, she doesn't like to be unemployed.
Yeah.
So she doesn't want to leave one man until the next man has appeared.
Mm-hmm.
And she doesn't have her next man lined up. So she is not ready to let go of Jerry Anderson. And she, you know, comes down to Baltimore and tries to kind of worm her way back in there. And this is not something Jerry wants at all. He really is done with her.
Yeah, she's a survivor. She's tough. And
she uses what she has at her disposal, and what she has at her disposal, beauty
mm-hmm.
and wit and, you know, certain wiles.
And she's expensive.
Yeah.
It costs a lot to maintain that lifestyle. This situation where you have the writer who's had the one really successful book. I mean, we see this so often. You know so many writers. You know the ones that, well, I could name a half dozen just off the top of my head. You've got Robert James Waller with The Bridges of Madison County, and then after that, you know, his first book, and then he kind of made some bestsellers after that, but it was they were derivative. They were based on that one. You've got Taya Obrecht with The Tiger's Wife. Her first book was a huge book, and the second one took her forever to write it. It didn't sell very well. Mitch Albom, Tuesdays with Maury, same deal. Big selling book. Then
Terry Anderson would be horrified to hear himself compared to Mitch Albom. Terry would not stand for that. But, I mean, and I think Taya is a writer who is going to continue and is going to keep surprising. A big first novel is an interesting fate. I mean, obviously the most famous one is To Kill a Mockingbird.
Uh-huh.
And there wasn't really a follow-up. But I'm more interested in writers because I'm actually this kind of writer where my books are on like a little bit of a roller coaster of sales. I mean, they do well enough, but some do really well, some do okay, and there's no rhyme or reason to it. I mean, unlike Jerry, I'm not known for one book, but I'm more prolific than Jerry. And I also work in genre where I think the standards are a little bit different. But yeah, I mean, Jerry to me is interesting because he identifies with a previous generation of writers quite without justification, in my opinion. But Jerry, you know, in the book clearly is like, he feels like he should be grouped with Bellow and Updike and Roth.
Mm-hmm.
And the ways in which Jerry is most like Bellow and Updike and Roth is probably in the way he writes about women, which doesn't even occur to him. He doesn't see himself as having a problem with women. He doesn't see misogyny in his work. You know, he's quite put out that there's been sort of like this revisionist criticism written by younger, more feminist critics that his books overly dependent upon men achieving liberation or wisdom or freedom through female death.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I definitely cribbed from one of my favorite all-time essays by Mary Gordon, which is called Good Boys and Dead Girls, where mm-hmm. she made that case against Faulkner, Updike, and Dreiser. What do we do with problematic writers? Like, how do you, and what she said was, you know, with problematic writers, and Philip Roth is very much the problematic writer of my heart, you have to learn how to read them critically. And if there are pleasures and joys for you in reading these people, by all means, don't abandon them. But when, and this is Mary Gordon's language, if you see this writer as a travel guide who takes you to a fetid swamp and tries to tell you it's a waterfall, you have to be able to see through that. And so I think Jerry is someone, you know, Jerry is a boomer. He's not one of those mid-century great American writers. He doesn't have the body of work, really. But he's definitely someone who at a certain time of year sits down wondering if the phone's going to ring and it's the Nobel Prize Committee.
Mm.
He's that full of himself.
Yeah. Kind of like Philip Roth, who we had the big blow up over the Blake Bailey biography after I'm sure you'd already put this book to bed. And Philip Roth, Zuckerman Unbound, a little connection there?
Huge connection. It was that and Misery are the two biggest influences on that book. And Zuckerman Unbound is one of my favorite Roth novels. I'm talking to you from my living room. Most of my fiction is in my office. But I keep what I consider, I guess, the most classic or important books here. And that's actually a collection I've been changing up over time. I've been asking some hard questions of myself of what makes a great book, and making sure that my own shelves are diverse and inclusive.
Mm-hmm.
But I have an entire shelf of Roth, because Roth fills an entire shelf. I have everything he wrote. He's an important writer to me. Long before there was any discussion about the biographer in the case of Roth, I had actually made a very private decision that I wasn't going to see, because I realized I'm not that interested in writers' lives. And I always felt that when Roth wrote his autobiography, which he called The Facts, that he was slyly making the case that none of this mattered. The Facts is a really kind of strangely inert book, and he does like kind of give you the gossip, and it's not pleasing. And of course, it's actually disturbing when it comes to his first wife, toward whom, you know, Roth has historically just been remarkably unfair. But so, yeah, I'm less and less interested in writers' lives. I'll read a craft book. I'm fascinated in how writers write. I loved reading about Francine Prose, who was recently profiled in the New York Times. Like, you know, I like to get inside their minds and hear what they have to say about their work and what inspires them and what gets them going and how they write. The details of their private lives, I just don't feel that much light. And I know that's not a particularly popular view, but in the end, you know, I always come back, and this is cited in Dream Girl. You know, Jerry's right about some stuff. Just because he's off doesn't mean he's not right sometimes. And he cites Eudora Welty and her memoir about, in the end, I won't get it exactly right word for word, but she's like, you can see I've led a sheltered life, but I also hope I've led a daring one, because all great daring comes from within. And I have long been really interested in writers who have not had particularly eventful lives, because I didn't. I don't have any material. I have very little to draw on if I'm going to write. And I certainly wasn't going to get to, I always get a little bit confused, but I think this is technically my 24th novel, maybe my 25th if we count the novella, or maybe it's my 24th. I do get confused no matter how many times I count up. You just can't produce that much material out of your own life, because if you're living the kind of life that can produce 24 novels, you got no time to write.
I was amused that Francine Prose said that she's easily bored by books.
I thought that was fascinating. Yeah. And I actually thought it was kind of a good point to be reminded, because, you know, the thing about books, and it became very popular recently in the past, you know, when books started, when TV started going to this serial form that became so popular on HBO, and people started comparing TV shows to novels. Yeah. The thing that really distinguishes the best, difficult television show from, like, the dumbest, easily read novel is that the hardest TV show in the world, a show full of, like, Easter eggs and clues and difficult things to pick up on, it goes forward without you doing anything. You just have to sit up and stay awake. And the dumbest book in the world requires the reader provide the forward momentum. I mean, I guess you can argue, well, what about audiobooks? And it's true, an audiobook will go forward of its own accord. But audiobooks require immense concentration. I listen to them, so I know. Don't usually do them for fiction, because I can't do it for fiction. I need extremely linear, often travelogue works for me in audio. But like I said, the dumbest book in the world can't, if the reader can't keep turning the pages. And I thought it was great that Prose reminded us that, you know, books can't be boring. And it seems like such a obvious idea, right? That books can't be boring. I think that literary writers, unlike genre writers, and I am a genre writer, I think literary writers struggle with this idea of unputdownable books. I think it makes them feel a little bit cheap. I've noticed lately that it's common for literary fiction to be blurbed. There's like a very book that was published last month, Morningside Heights, and one of the blurbs was, it reads like a suspense novel. I was like, oh, wow, what a trick. What are you telling me? It reads like a novel that people can't stop reading. Whoa. Lots of literary novels read that way. There are a lot of page turners among literary fiction. The page turner should be more or less the standard. Even when the book is enormously difficult, you should want to keep going. If it's a duty that you show up for, if we turn books to overcooked, boiled vegetables, look, it's not going to work. Books should have almost kind of a decadent appeal. You should feel almost guilty because the book is such a private solo act, you can watch TV communally. You can be together with your family. And this is actually something I struggled with during the pandemic of I wanted to watch movies because I could do that communally within my pod. But there's something about being all alone with a book which is very, very seductive to me.
That's how I felt reading Dreamgirl, Laura.
Wow, thank you.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Laura Lippman. We're talking about Dreamgirl, her new novel. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, amplifying voices from every corner of our community. Jerry, your writer, he's nostalgic about soap operas, the old soap operas, where the story never really ends.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And it's where the story is incremental. I happen to, you know, that's one place where Jerry and I are kind of lining up, and I was thinking about it too. And it happened long after Dreamgirl was finished. As a matter of fact, Dreamgirl was practically published when one of my favorite podcasts called Decoder Ring did a piece on like a seminal moment in the history of soap operas. It's really fascinating. It was about a rape storyline on One Life to Live that was very conscious of previous rape storylines in which the villain and victim ended up in romantic relationships, which is just really icky. And, you know, there's certain forms. When you look at them and you really think about them, really think about what a soap opera does, it's fascinating. And also the fact that a soap opera never knows when it's going to end. So it just has to go day to day. I will cop to where I steal, because I believe that, you know, immature artists imitate, mature artists steal. There's a book I'm crazy about called Kinflix, which is a first novel. Amazing first novel. And that was her observation about how soap operas swing back and forth between the most mundane things and the most wild things. And of course, she was writing in the 70s as soap operas began to really have to compete for attention in the 80s and 90s. They got crazier and crazier and crazier. But I'm a respecter of forms. Genre is a form. Literary fiction is a form. I am fascinated by various poetic forms, which I cannot do at all. And I just think that form imposes such an interesting discipline, whatever the form is. And I think it would be very, very hard to write a good soap opera. And a lot of people did it. I don't think I could be one of them.
Well, Dreamgirl is a bit of a horror novel, isn't it?
I hope so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It certainly was inspired by one of the great horror novels, which is Misery. And it's also, it pays tribute to the scariest book I ever read in my life, which is Ghost Story by Peter Straub. A tiny moment that is definitely stolen from the film. Jerry and his nurse even end up watching the film. After he's had a bad scare. And yeah, I'm interested in horror. Horror is another thing I have to do by myself. No one else in my household wants to watch horror movies with me. So I often watch horror alone. And I can't even identify for myself. And I prefer it in film. Mm-hmm. There are some horror novels that I adore. I mean, I don't even think Shirley Jackson is properly horror. Are we supposed to call her gothic? Sometimes I get confused, but she scares the dickens out of me, so I'll consider that horror. But I really like watching horror movies alone. There was something on Twitter the other day, which is like, what's the best movie to watch on 4th of July? And I think most people were thinking about patriotic films or something like Independence Day.
Uh-huh.
The film that I watched on 4th of July, because it was so hot out, I watched John Carpenter's The Thing. Just because I so enjoyed being at the South Pole. But also, I just like that movie. I still have a fondness for it after all these years.
Mm-hmm. You have many selected flashbacks throughout the book to his life. And some of them are flashbacks to when he was teaching, a la Philip Roth, college courses in writing. He has a syllabus for advanced creative writing in which he has suggested reading and books like Zuckerman Unbound and Ghost Story by Peter Straub, and suggested viewing movies. And I kept flashing on a particular movie because For one thing, you mentioned the word Hitchcock a couple of times in the story, and I kept flashing on Jimmy Stewart in Rear Window, crippled, his legs broken, he's looking out the window, but poor Jerry, he doesn't have the view that Jimmy had.
No, he doesn't, and it's funny, I didn't think about Rear Window as much because I felt like I'd really done my tribute to Rear Window and also Daughter of Time when I wrote my novella, Girl in the Green Raincoat, which Tess Monahan is confined to bed because of a difficult pregnancy and in her final trimester, and she does see crime or what appears to be a crime out of the windows of her home, and it's about how does she detect when she can't move and what are the ramifications of trying to track down a murderer when you're extremely vulnerable. But yeah, I can definitely see the Rear Window comparison. It wasn't uppermost in my mind. Mm. I was much more in tune with the idea of misery. Look, you're not anyone without your readers when you're a writer.
Mm-hmm.
It's a completely dependent. I mean, I don't exist as a writer unless I have readers, and I'm not even talking about my financial existence. I feel like my book doesn't exist until someone reads it. And the more people who read it, the more it exists and it has more lives and more varieties. But it's a very existential thing. In Misery, the writer meets a person who proclaims herself to be his number one fan and then has to deal with the demands of the fan. And that's an interesting and ongoing saga, especially now with fan fiction and things people are, and I wrote fan fiction. I'm no enemy of it. Jerry's not meeting his number one fan. The people who move through Jerry's life, even Margot, it turns out, they all want to be writers.
Mm.
And it's not even clear that some of them are readers. So I was thinking a lot about that relationship, the relationship between the writer and the reader. Also the relationship between the writer and the would-be writer, because that is one very fraught relationship.
I love the little Easter egg you tossed us when you had the cameo by Tess Monahan. That was cute.
And well, who else did you hire? PI in Baltimore. It's a small town.
It was cute.
Baltimore really does live up to its Smaltimore name, believe me.
Laura Lippman has joined us. Her new one is Dream Girl. And Laura, I just saw a statistic that showed that people who have finished reading Dream Girl are more likely to go out and buy a new freezer than just a normal reader.
Hey, I bought a small freezer and put it in my basement while I was working on Dream Girl. That's a true story.
Yeah.
During the pandemic, we had so much more food in the house. You're like, you know, buying at much greater intervals. So, you know, very handy.
Yeah, well,
very handy. And as someone in the book says to Jerry, it's amazing what you can learn on the internet.
Well, readers will have to discover what we're laughing about in the story Dream Girl. And I love this story so much, Laura. And thank you so much for joining us to talk about it.
Oh, it's a delight to talk to you as always. This is a really fun conversation, and I so appreciate you wanting to talk to me.
Will you take good care, and I'll keep following you on Twitter.
Back at you, Vic.
Okay.
I really had fun today.
The book is The Dream Girl. Dream Girl, I should say. Just Dream Girl by Laura Lippman. And you heard about it on the Book Nook for the Book Nook. I'm Vic McKeonis.